Today, by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada and Acharyas, we'll be taking a serious look at the second chapter of Prabhupada's Krishna book, prayers by the demigods for Lord Krishna. Before we do that, I have a question. Which demigods are we talking about? There are unlimited demigods. If you're talking numbers, you're looking at something like 33 million. Did they all come to pray? Which demigods came? As we read through today's chapter, we'll come to understand that it's primarily the universal administrators that we'll be hearing about, and some other very special souls like Narayana, he never misses out, and Vyasadeva. So I thought that what we'd do is to get a little insight into these administrators, the universal administrators. Prabhupada mentions them and their position in chapter 36 of Nectar of Devotion. There he says, devotees engaged in servitude are attached to Krishna in the affection of reverence. The devotees of the Lord in servitude are divided into four categories. Appointed servants, such as Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, these are the two main ones that will be praying, who are appointed to control the material modes of passion and ignorance. Devotees in servitude who are protected by the Lord. Devotees are always associates, and devotees are simply following in the footsteps of the Lord. So we're looking at appointed servants, and Prabhupada gives an elaboration in a very sweet way. In a conversation between Jambavati, one of Krishna's wives, and Kalindi, her friend, Jambavati inquired, who is this personality circumambulating our Krishna? Kalindi replied, she is Ambika, the superintendent of all universal affairs. Then Jambavati inquired, who is this personality who is trembling at the sight of Krishna? Kalindi replied, oh, he's Lord Shiva. Then Jambavati inquired, who is the person offering prayers? Kalindi replied, he's Lord Brahma. Jambavati then asked, who is that person who has fallen on the ground and is offering respect to Krishna? Kalindi replied, he is Indra, the king of heaven. Jambavati next inquired, who's that person who's come with the demigods and is laughing with them? Kalindi replied, oh, he's my older brother, Jamaraj, the superintendent of death. This conversation offers a description of all the demigods, including Jamaraj, who engaged in services appointed by the Lord. They are called Adhikrita Devata, or demigods appointed to particular types of departmental service. So they're not only going on behalf of Bhumi Devi, who came to express her concern, drastic concern, to Brahma, but we're looking at other demigods and their difficulties. Now, of course, we have to remember that in this particular Divya Yuga, the Brahma that we're looking at is a pure devotee. So we saw in the first chapter, although he's an administrator, universal administrator, highly evolved personality, when Bhumi Devi comes to him and expresses her grief, his mood is not that of the usual administrator. His mood is that he becomes aggrieved at her grief, and he immediately wants to help her. So when we see that paradukha dukhi mood, this feeling suffering when seeing another suffer, we know we're talking about a devotee. But not all demigods. There are a lot of demigods that can be tried as his main ones. They weren't seen. Maybe they were frightened of Kansa. But there are a number of other devotees that came, and a very big difficulty with being a demigod is that even though very highly evolved personalities, they are taking on amazing responsibility for Krishna. But the reality is that they're sakama. They have devotion for Krishna, but they also have material desires, independent desires. So where there's independent desire, where there's material desire, maybe this, you can relate to this, I certainly can. When there's material desire, and this you'll find even on the heavenly planets, there will be envy, there will be enmity, There will be anxiety and there will be fear. So one thing that we should be aware of is that this kamsa that we're going to be hearing about, he was quite, he didn't just have a fixation, he wasn't just a small time king in Mathura who had a fixation that he wanted to kill Krishna. He was actually causing universal disturbance. So Jiva Goswami, he tells us that one of the reasons that they were so joyful that Swayam Bhagavan Krishna was going to appear, and one of the reasons they offered their prayers, was that they were overjoyed that Swayam Bhagavan Krishna is coming. That means his earthly pastimes. And those earthly pastimes are sweeter than even Golok pastimes. So they wanted to see those pastimes. They were joyous about that. But there was another side of the picture. And Gauga Samhita gives us an insight into that, which I thought I'd read a little of it just to explain what a nasty character this Kamsa is and the kind of damage that he is doing, not only in Mathura and surrounding areas, but on other planets. On the planet of the demigods. So quite something. It starts with, this is from the 7th chapter of Gauga Samhita. Starts with a description of him. His chest a great door, his shoulders broad, his arms massive, his eyes lotus flowers, his hair long, his complexion ruddy, his garments black, wearing a helmet, earrings, necklace, and lotus garland. Effulgent as the sun at the time of cosmic dissolution, wielding his sword, shield, quiver, arrows, and club, proud Kamsa went to Amaravati to conquer the demigods. Aided by Chanura, Mustika, Arista, Sala, Tosal, Kesi, Pralamba, Baka, Dravida, Trinavata, Aga, Kuta, Narakasura, Banas, Ambara, Vyoma, Denaka, and Vatsa, he's conquered all these demons, made them his allies by conquering them. All of them together, they besieged the city of the demigods. Seeing that the demons, headed by Kamsa, had come, Indra, the sovereign king of the demigods, became angry, and accompanied by a great host of demigods, went to fight with them. Then they fought a terrible, tumultuous battle that made everyone's hair stand up on end. When hosts of sharp and glistening arrows and divine weapons created a blinding darkness, King Indra, riding on a chariot, threw his thunderbolt at Kamsa. With his club, the great demon Kamsa struck the thunderbolt. Its streams of lightning broken, it fell to the battlefield. Abandoning the thunderbolt, Indra took up a sword and angrily struck Kamsa on the head, making a terrible sound. Kamsa remained unhurt, like an elephant struck by a flower gun. Then he took a great and heavy club made of 8 metals, and how heavy that club was. Then the demon king Kamsa threw that very, very heavy club at Indra. Seeing it coming, Indra simply caught it and threw it back at the demon. Then Indra, cutting his enemies to pieces and his chariot driven by Matali, went into battle. Taking an iron club, Kamsa struck Indra on the shoulder. Because of that blow, Indra, the king of the demigods and enemy of the demons, became momentarily unconscious. Then all the Maruts covered Kamsa with a great and splendid flood of arrows, like a monsoon cloud covering the sun, making a great sound as he worked many bows with his thousands of arms. The powerful warrior Banasura drove them back with his host of arrows. Surrounding him as a host of elephants might surround a mountain, the Basus, Rajas, Adityas, Ribhus, and Suras attacked by Nisroch with great variety of weapons. Then, assisted by Palumba and the other demons, Narakasura came and made a great horrendous sound. That sound made the demigods fall unconscious on the battlefield. Quickly rising, and his eyes now red, Indra mounted his furious four-tusked elephant, Airavata. Now provoked by the striking of the goad, trumpeting with its trunk, crushing its enemies under its moving feet, its right flowing, as unapproachable as a mountain of snow, jingling its chains, moving its trunk again and again, opulent with bells, decorated with a jewel sallow and network of tricking ornaments, and its face decorated with pictures and designs drawing Mas, Sindhu, and Gomutra, Indra made Airavata charge, Pangsa, with a mighty hard punch. Pangsa struck the great elephant, and with a second mighty punch, he struck Indra. With these punches, Indra fell far away, and the elephant was wounded and fell on its knees to the ground. Again standing up, the king of the elephants attacked the demon king Kangsa with its tusks, picked him up with its trunk, and threw him 800,000 miles away. His body as hard as a thunderbolt. When Kangsa fell, he was only a little upset in his heart. Angry and his lips trembling, he returned to the battlefield. Kangsa grabbed the elephant king Airavata, threw him onto the battleground, strangled his trunk and broke his tusks into pieces. Knocking over many great heroes, the elephant then fled the battlefield and went to the capital of the demigods. Taking the bow of Lord Vishnu and stringing it with a flood of arrows accompanied by the twanging sound of the bow, the demon king Kangsa made the demigods flee. As Kangsa was attacking and killing them, the dispirited demigods fled in all directions. Some lost their helmets and shields and screamed in terror. Some, dropping their weapons and armor, humbly surrendered with folded hands. Others, very troubled, lost all desire to even try and stand before Kangsa. Seeing that the demigods were fleeing, Kangsa simply laughed in satisfaction, proudly took Indra's throne and his parasol, and returned with all the demigods to his own capital, Mathura. So quite a character. Very powerful personality, so the demons had good reason to pray to Krishna. And it wasn't just because they wanted to see his earthly pastimes, they wanted to get rid of this Kangsa. It's creating such a disturbance. Okay, so now let's enter into this most amazing chapter, second chapter, prayers by the demigods to Lord Krishna in the womb. Sidhani, would you like to read?
Yes, Matthew. King Kamsa not only occupied the kingdoms of the Yadu, Bhoja, and Andaka dynasties and the kingdom of Shurasen, but he also made alliances with all other demoniac kings as follows: the demon Pralamba, demon Baka, demon Chanur, demon Trinavarta, demon Agasur, demon Mushtika, demon Arishta, demon Drivida, demon Putana, demon Keshi, and demon Denuka. At that time, Jarasan was the king of Magad province, known at present as Bihar state. Thus, by his diplomatic policy, Kansa consolidated the most powerful kingdom of his time under the protection of Jarasandha. He made further alliances with such kings as Banasur and Bhaumasur until he was the strongest. Then he began to behave most inimically toward the Yadu dynasty, into which Krishna was to take his birth. Being harassed by Kansa, the kings of the Yadu, Bhoja, and Andaka dynasties began to take shelter in different states, such as the state of the Kurus, the state of the Panchalas, the state known as Kekheya, Shalva, Vidharba, Nishad, Videha, and Kosha.
Okay, so Jiva Goswami makes a little comment about that. that he's talking here particularly about the Yadus, and Jiva Goswami tells us that they not only lived in secret, but they were actually hiding in farming and cowherd villages, and that hiding meant they were actually dressing as farmers and cowherds. So they didn't maintain any of their regal status as kings, but took on the dress and the lifestyle of the farmers and the cowherders in the villages.
Kamsa broke the solidarity of the Yadu kingdom as well as the Bhoja and Andhaka. He made his position the most solid within the vast tract of land known at this time at that time as Bharatavarsha. When Kamsa was killing the six babies of Devaki and Vasudev, one after another, many friends and relatives of Kamsa approached him and requested him to discontinue these heinous activities. But all of them became worshippers of Kamsa.
Both Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and Prabhupada in his Bhagavatam Gopa says something to say about this. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that being eager to see the Lord, some of the Yadus, such as Akrura, became cooperative with Krishna and lived with him in Mathura. Being eager to see the Lord, some of the others, such as Akrura, became cooperative with Kamsa and lived with him in Mathura. So they were not so interested in Kamsa, but they were interested in being in Mathura at that time because of Krishna's coming birth. And then in Prabhupada, he has a statement to say also, this is his purport to 10.25. Some of the chief devotees, such as Akrura, stayed with Kamsa to satisfy him. This they did for various purposes. They all expected the Supreme Personality of Godhead to appear as the eighth child as soon as Devaki's other children were killed by Kamsa, and they were eagerly awaiting his appearance. By remaining in Kamsa's association, they will be able to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead take birth and display his childhood pastimes. And Akrura would later go to Vrindavan to bring Krishna Balaram to Mathura. The word Pariyaprasute is significant because it indicates that some devotees wanted to stay near Kamsa in order to see all these pastimes of the Lord. The six children killed by Kamsa had formerly been sons of Marichi, but because of having been cursed by a Brahmana, they obliged to take birth as grandsons of Hiranyakashipu. Kamsa had taken birth as Kalanemi, and now he was obliged to kill his own sons. This was a mystery. As soon as the sons of Devaki were killed, they were returned to their original place. The devotees in Mathura wanted to see this also. So the Jnanis, they had the Jignasya tendency, curious, and see things. So they had, these were the reasons that they wanted to see what was going on.
When Devaki became pregnant for the seventh time, a plenary expansion of Krishna known as Ananta appeared within her womb.
Okay, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says something interesting about this. Although Rohini is the eternal mother of Balaram, because of Krishna's request, he appeared in Devaki's womb first. After establishing Sesha, his answer there, as Krishna's bed and seat, he then desired to go to the womb of his own mother. So Balaram set up everything, all his facilities for him, and then he went to his own mother.
Devaki was overwhelmed with both jubilation and lamentation. She was joyful, for she could understand that Lord Vishnu had taken shelter within her womb. But at the same time, she was sorry that as soon as her child would come out, Kamsa would kill him. At that time, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, being compassionate about the Yadus, who were fearful due to the atrocities committed by Kamsa, ordered the appearance of Yogamaya, his internal potency. Krishna is the Lord of the universe, but he's especially the Lord of the Yadu dynasty. Yogamaya is the principal potency of the Personality of Godhead. In the Vedas, it is stated that the Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has multipotencies. Parasya Shakti Vividhai Vashruyate. All the different potencies are acting externally and internally, and Yogmaya is the chief of all potencies.
Vishwanath has something to say here also. It's quite deep, so listen carefully, you may miss it otherwise. The conjunction of material and spiritual in Krishna's pastimes is there to illustrate the methodical nature of bhakti. While devotees perform sadhana bhakti in the form of hearing and chanting about Krishna, they also enjoy the six material sense objects, which is a secondary effect of bhakti. At that time, the devotee cries out pitifully, "O Krishna, because of this enjoyment, I will fall down into the dark well of material existence." When a devotee shows fear of material enjoyment, gradually the tendency to enjoy matter subsides. Then bhakti, in the form of hearing and chanting Krishna's names, glorifying his transcendental forms, qualities and pastimes, and serving the Lord in various ways, becomes prominent. Finally, Krishna himself, the ocean of all wonderful forms and qualities, appears within the heart of the devotee. Then he compares what he's just said to Devaki. Since Devaki possesses the power to make the Lord appear, she can be considered the incarnation of bhakti. Kamsa can be considered the incarnation of fear, as it is often said, out of fear of Kamsa. Just as fear of the material world removes the six sense objects from the womb of bhakti, so Kamsa destroyed the six children of Devaki. Krishna Prem, which is characterized by intense service of the Lord, necessarily appears in the womb of bhakti after the desire for sense objects is extinguished. Similarly, Ananta, the personified form of service to the Lord, appeared as the seventh child of Devaki. As Sri Krishna himself appears after Prema Bhakti appears, so Bhagavan himself appeared as the eighth child of Devaki after Sesha appeared. Quite an amazing comparison that he's making.
Which one is this?
And that is from text 8 purport.
The Lord ordered the appearance of Yogamaya in the land of Rajbhumi in Vrindavan, which is always decorated and full with beautiful cows. In Vrindavan, Rohini...
He also says something about that, which is quite sweet and simple. It's interesting. He's saying, it is not mentioned that Yogamaya will become the daughter of Yashoda, though it is mentioned that Krishna will become the son of Devaki. Yashoda will not have affection for Yogamaya as a daughter. This means that her presence in Braj will not be noticed by anyone. It will simply be a support to the Leela. So she's coming in as an energy of Krishna to support the Leela, but doesn't have the position of being a daughter of Yashoda. There's no recognition of that. So that's also a sweet little point that he's making there.
In Vrindavan, Rohini, one of the wives of Vasudev, was residing at the house of King Nanda and Queen Yashoda. Not only Rohini, but many others in the Yadu dynasty were scattered all over the country due to their fear of the atrocities of Kamsa. Some of them were even living in the caves of the mountains.
Vishwanath Chakravarti and Prabhupada both have something to say about this. Vishwanath Chakravarti Chakravarti tells us that after Devaki's six children were killed, Vasudev, seeing Rohini pregnant, sent her secretly to Nanda Gokul. So he was fearful that Kamsa might get an idea about Rohini as well. So rather than take that risk, he sent her secretly to Nandagam, or to Gokul. And then Prabhupada, it's not actually Prabhupada, it's in the verse itself, verse 7 of this chapter, mention is made that it wasn't only Rohini that was living in the home of Nanda Maharaj, but other wives of Vasudeva were also living there incognito because of fear of Kamsa. So she wasn't the only one that was there. It was quite a big disturbance, and they had to take a lot of precaution to protect these devotees. Mm.
The Lord thus informed Yogamaya, under the imprisonment of Kansa are Devaki and Vasudev, and at the present moment my plenary expansion, Shesha, is within the womb of Devaki. You can arrange the transfer of Shesha from the womb of Devaki to the womb of Rohini. After this arrangement, I am personally going to appear in the womb of Devaki with my full potencies. Then I shall appear as the son of Devaki and Vasudev, and you shall appear as the daughter of Nanda and Yashoda in Vrindavan.
Jiva Goswami and Prabhupada has something to say about this. Well, Srila Prabhupada tells us in his purport to verse 8, the first plenary expansion of Krishna's Baladeva, also known as Sesha, the Sesha incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, supports the entire universe. And the eternal mother of this incarnation is Mother Rohini. Because I'm going into the womb of Devaki, the Lord told Yogamaya, the Sesha incarnation has already gone there and made suitable arrangements so that I may live there. Now he should enter the womb of Rohini, his eternal mother. And then Jiva Goswami, he quotes from Harivansa to explain how the child was actually transferred. He doesn't go into a lot of detail, but it was quite something. What he does say is quite something. Yoga Nidra means Yoga Maya, since sleep takes away the intelligence of all people. Yoga Maya did this with great skill, so that Devaki would not suffer, Rohini would not be astonished, and the people could not see it happen. One should understand the sequence of events according to Harivansa. Vasudev first placed the child in Devaki's womb, and Rohini then went to Gokul. In the 7th month of pregnancy, the embryo was transferred from Devaki to Rohini, 7th month of pregnancy. In the middle of the night, Devaki aborted her child and fell on the ground unconscious. As if in a dream, she saw the child come out of her womb and felt pain for some moments on seeing her child. Yogamaya spoke to Rohini in the darkness of night as she slept. The child taken from another woman placed in your womb will be your son named Sankarshan. So very mystical happening. 7th month for a transfer from one room to another at 7 months is quite an achievement. Nothing's impossible for Krishna and his energies.
Since you will appear as my contemporary sister, and since you will quickly satisfy desires for sense gratification, people within the world will worship you with all kinds of valuable presentations, incense, candles, flowers, and offerings of sacrifice. People who are after materialistic perfection will worship you under the different forms of your expansions, which will be named Durga, Bhadrakali, Vijaya, Vaishnavi, Kumuda, Chandika, Krishna, Madhavi, Kanyaka, Maya, Narayani, Ishani, Sharada, and Ambika.
Prabhupada has a few comments to make about this. The first one is in his purport to the verse 10. Those who are interested in remaining in this material world and are not interested in spiritual salvation have many duties. But for one who is interested in spiritual salvation, the only duty is to surrender fully unto Krishna. Such a person is not interested in material enjoyment. So they're obviously not going to be interested in worshipping the demigods. Then in his purport to 11-12, he says, Srila Vijayadvaja Tirthapad, in his Padaratnavali Tikka, has explained the meanings of the different representations. Maya is known as Durga because she is approached with great difficulty, as Bhadra because she is inauspicious, and as Kali because she is deep blue. Because she is the most powerful energy, she is known as Vijay. Because she is one of the different energies of Vishnu, she is known as Vaishnavi. And because she enjoys in this material world and gets facilities for material enjoyment, She is known as Kumuda. Because she's very severe to her enemies, the Asuras, she is known as Chandika. And because she gives all sorts of material facilities, she is called Krishna. In this way, the material energy is differently named and situated in different places on the surface of the globe. So just an interesting detail why she has the different names. And that it's interesting that people are attracted to these different forms and have different qualities. Yeah.
When we call out the name of, say, Mahamaya and the Yogmaya, so how is this the difference? That because Durga always felt is Mahamaya, or
she's a manifestation, but there are many manifestations. This is what we're reading here. So many different ways that she's expanding. She has, Durga has a particular role. She is the prison house superintendent. But all these other, she's manifesting in so many forms.
But they are, as mentioned, it's all forms of Yogamaya only. Mm.
No, it's originally coming from Yogamaya, but they're sort of manifesting in the material sky for a different purpose, and they can't be seen as Yogamaya at that time.
Yes.
They're a more or less a distortion of her purpose and interest. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Krishna and Yogamaya appeared as brother and sister, the supreme powerful and the supreme power. Although there is no clear distinction between the powerful and the power, power is always subordinate to the powerful. Those who are materialistic are worshippers of the power, but those who are transcendentalists are worshippers of the powerful. Krishna is the supreme powerful, and Durga is the supreme power within the material world. Actually, people in the Vedic culture worship both the powerful and the power. There are many hundreds and thousands of temples of Vishnu and Devi, and sometimes they are worshipped simultaneously. The worshipper of the power Durga, or the external energy of Krishna, may achieve all kinds of material success very easily, but anyone who wants to be elevated transcendentally must engage in worshipping the powerful in Krishna consciousness. The Lord also declared to Yogamaya, "My plenary expansion, Annunciation, is within the womb of Devaki. On account of being forcibly attracted to the womb of Rohini, he will be known as Sankarshan and will be the source of all spiritual power or bal, by which one can attain the highest bliss of life, which is called Ramana. Therefore, the plenary portion, Ananta, will be known after his appearance, either as Sankarshan or as Balaram." In the Upanishads, it stated, "Nayam Atma Balhinena Labhya." The purport is that one cannot attain the supreme platform of self-realization without being sufficiently favored by Balaram. Bala does not mean physical strength. No one can attain spiritual perfection by physical strength. One must have the spiritual strength which is infused by Balaram or Sankarshan. Ananta or Shesha is the source of the power which sustains all the planets in their different positions. Materially, this sustaining power is known as the law of gravitation, but actually it is the display of the potency of Sankarshan. Balaram or Sankarshan is the source of spiritual power or the original spiritual master. Therefore, Lord Nityanand Prabhu, who is also the incarnation of Balaram, is the original spiritual master. And the spiritual master is the representative of Balaram, the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who supplies spiritual strength. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is confirmed that the spiritual master is the manifestation of the mercy of Krishna. Thus, ordered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Yogamaya circumambulated the Lord and then appeared within this material world according to his order.
Prabhupada comments on that. He tells us that after receiving the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Yogamaya twice confirmed her acceptance by saying, "Yes, sir, I shall do your order," and then saying Om. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments on Om, that Om signifies Vedic confirmation. Thus Yogamaya very faithfully received the Lord's order as a Vedic injunction. So she took her work very seriously, and she took it as a Vedic injunction that she should do it.
When Yogmaya, the supreme power of the supremely powerful personality of Godhead, transferred Lord Shesha from the womb of Devaki to the womb of Rohini, both Devaki and Rohini were under Yogmaya's spell, which is called Yoga Nidra. When this was done, people thought that Devaki's seventh pregnancy had been a miscarriage.
So both Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Srila Prabhupada comment on this. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, so the citizens suspected that Kamsa must have done some black magic to cause the miscarriage. And he explains that they felt like that because of their deep affection for Devaki. So when you have deep affection for someone, you're always looking for reasons
to blame others.
So this is what was happening there. And then Prabhupada, I'll read the verse, it's verse 15, and I'll read a little of Prabhupada's purport. When the child of Devaki was attracted and transferred into the womb of Rohini by Yoga Maya, Devaki seemed to have a miscarriage. So all the inhabitants of the palace loudly lamented, "Alas, Devaki has lost her child." Purport by Prabhupada. All the inhabitants of the palace includes Kamsa. When everyone lamented, Kamsa joined in compassion, thinking that perhaps because of drugs or some other external means, Devaki had undergone this abortion. So he's got a completely different idea. The real story of what happened after Yogamaya attracted the child of Devaki into the womb of Rohini in the seventh month of Rohini's pregnancy is described in Harivamsa. And then he repeats what we heard earlier from Jiva Goswami. At midnight, where Rohini was deeply sleeping, she experienced as if in a dream that she had undergone a miscarriage. After some time, when she awoke, she saw that this had indeed happened and she was in great anxiety. Yogamaya then informed her, "Auspicious lady, your child is now being replaced. I'm attracting a child from the womb of Devaki, and therefore your child will be known as Sankarshan." Really quite something. Okay.
Thus, although Balaram appeared as the son of Devaki, he was transferred to the womb of Rohini to appear as her son. After this arrangement, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, who's always ready to protect his unalloyed devotees, entered within the mind of Vasudev as the Lord of the whole creation, with full inconceivable potencies. It is understood in this connection that Lord Krishna first of all situated himself in the unalloyed heart of Vasudev and was then transferred to the heart of Devaki. He was not put into the womb of Devaki by seminal discharge. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, by His inconceivable potency, can appear in any way. It is not necessary for Him to appear in the ordinary way by seminal injection within the womb of a woman. When Vasudev was sustaining the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead within His heart, He appeared just like the glowing sun, whose shining rays are always unbearable and scorching to the common man.
The Bhagavatam verse is interesting in relation to this. It's verse 17. While carrying the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead within the core of his heart, Vasudeva bore the Lord's transcendently illuminating effulgence, and thus he became as bright as the sun. He was therefore very difficult to see or approach through sensory perception. Indeed, he was unapproachable and unperceivable even with such formidable men as Kamsa, and not only for Kamsa, but all living entities. So he was so effulgent that people couldn't even see him. They couldn't even see his form. That's quite something.
The form of the Lord situated in the pure unalloyed heart of Vasudev is not different from the original form of Krishna. The appearance of the form of Krishna anywhere and specifically within the heart is called dham. Dham refers not only to Krishna's form, but also to his name, his qualities, and his paraphernalia. Everything becomes manifest simultaneously.
Prabhupada says something interesting about that also. I'll read the verse, it's verse 18. Verse 18. Thereafter, accompanied by plenary expansions, the fully opulent Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is all auspicious for the entire universe, was transferred from the mind of Vasudeva to the mind of Devaki. Devaki, having thus been initiated by Vasudev, became beautiful by carrying Lord Krishna, the original consciousness for everyone, the cause of all causes, within the core of her heart, just as the east becomes beautiful by carrying the rising moon. Little Prabhupada's Prabhupada. As indicated here by the word Manastaha, the Supreme Person of Godhead was transferred from the core of Vasudeva's mind or heart, the core of the heart of Devaki. We should note carefully that the Lord was transferred to Devaki not by the ordinary way of a human being, but by Diksha, initiation. Thus the importance of initiation is mentioned here. Unless one is initiated by the right person who always carries within his heart the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one cannot acquire the power to carry the Supreme Godhead within the core of one's own heart. And then Prabhupada makes a very sweet comment right at the end of the long purport. The Supreme Lord's entrance into the womb of Devaki from the heart of Vasudeva was a heart-to-heart relationship. Heart-to-heart. Very sweet.
Thus the eternal form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead with four potencies was transferred from the mind of Vasudeva to the mind of Devaki, exactly as the setting sun's rays are transferred to the full moon rising in the east.
Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says something about that. The Lord appeared in Devaki's mind without the effort that yogis exert to envision the Lord. Devaki held Krishna within her mind, and this, we understand, rules out any idea of material conception or birth, because she's holding him in her mind, and not in the way that yogis do, but in a way that's actually by the potency of Krishna, not by any of her potency. Of course, purity is there, but it's by the potency of Krishna.
Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, thus entered the body of Devaki from the body of Vasudeva without being subject to any kind of conditions of an ordinary living entity. Since Krishna was there, it is to be understood that all his plenary expansions, such as Narayan, and incarnations like Lord Narasimha and Varaha, were with him, and they also were not subject to the conditions of material existence. In this way, Devaki became the resident of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is one without a second and the cause of all creation. Devaki became the residence of the Absolute Truth, but because she was confined within the house of Kamsa, she looked just like a suppressed fire or like misused education. When fire is kept in a jug, the illuminating rays of the fire cannot be very much appreciated. Similarly, misused knowledge which does not benefit the people in general is not very much appreciated.
Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says a little bit about this analogy. In the prison house of Kamsa, Devaki was like a covered fire. When a fire is burning in a house, it does not illuminate the town, but only the objects or persons near it in the house. However, when the fire becomes strong, it can burn down the restricting house. In the same way, Devaki would in due time destroy Kamsa.
So Devaki was kept within the prison walls of Kamsa's palace, and no one could see her transcendental beauty, which resulted from her conceiving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Kamsa, however, saw the transcendental beauty of his sister Devaki, and he at once concluded that the Supreme Personality of Godhead had taken shelter in her womb. She had never before looked so wonderfully beautiful. He could distinctly understand that there was something wonderful within the womb of Devaki. In this way, Kamsa became perturbed because he was sure that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who would kill him in the future, had now come.
Prabhupada makes an interesting comment in relation to this in his 20th booklet. Krishna has taken birth or taken shelter within the womb of the Krishna consciousness movement. Men of Kamsa's class, therefore, are very much afraid and are busy trying to stop this movement. especially in the Western countries. One politician has remarked that the Krishna consciousness movement is spreading like an epidemic, and that if it is not checked immediately, within 10 years it may capture governmental power. There is, of course, such potency in the Krishna consciousness movement, as stated by authorities. Kali Kali Namarupa Krishna Avatar. In this age, Krishna has appeared in the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. The Krishna consciousness movement is spreading like wildfire all over the world, and it will go on doing so. Men who are like Kamsa are very much afraid of the movement's progress and acceptance by the younger generation. But as Krishna could not be killed by Kamsa, this movement cannot be checked by men of Kamsa's class. The movement will go on increasing more and more, provided the leaders of the movement remain firmly Krishna conscious by following the regulative principles and the primary activity of chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra regularly. So he's giving us some guidance here, how to keep the movement strong.
Kansa began to think, what is to be done with Devaki? Surely she has Vishnu or Krishna within her womb. So it is certain that Krishna has come to execute the mission of the demigods. And even if I immediately kill Devaki, his mission cannot be frustrated. Kansa knew very well that no one can frustrate the purpose of Vishnu. Any intelligent man can understand that the laws of God cannot be violated. His purpose will be served in spite of all impediments offered by the demons. Kansa thought, if I kill Devaki at the present moment, Vishnu will enforce his supreme will more vehemently. To kill Devaki just now would be a most abominable act. No one desires to kill his reputation, even in an awkward situation. If I kill Devaki now, my reputation will be spoiled. Devaki is a woman and she's under my shelter. She's pregnant, and if I kill her, immediately my reputation, the results of my pious activities, and my duration of life will all be finished.
Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti come on this. Interesting.
Such a character, because, you know, now he's talking,
he understands like
reputation and all that, and pious deeds.
In his terms, they have a different view of life. This is Jiva Goswami. Right now, immediately, this is Kansa speaking, right now, immediately, what should I do? His evil nature became restricted because of fear, and he thought of how to act for his own benefit. If I kill her, will it not be a temporary means to protect my life? If I kill her, will I not obtain long-lasting infamy and loss of wealth? It is bad to kill a woman, worse to kill my sister, and worse if she is pregnant. And by killing her, it is bad because I lose fame, which is worse than losing wealth and worse than losing long life. By killing her, my real life will be destroyed. What will be the good of that? So self-interest. And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he also talks about it quite interestingly. He's also speaking as Kamsa. What should I do about Hari in this circumstance? Is it proper to kill him while he is still an embryo? No, because those interested in their own welfare do not destroy their own good name. If I kill him now, my reputation of prowess will be destroyed. But if he is born and grows and then I fight with him, whether I'm victorious or defeated, my glory will remain intact. Killing a child in the womb is not an act of bravery. Therefore, such a deed will not only destroy my fame, but Dharma will also get destroyed. Thus, Kamsa rightly thinks that by killing a woman, a sister, and a fetus, he will vanquish his fame, power, and lifespan. This temporary restriction to Kamsa's evil nature is due to fear. Thus, Kamsa reflected upon his reputation through careful discrimination. What a character.
And he has already killed six.
I know.
Quite something.
He further deliberated, a person who's too cruel is as good as dead, even in this lifetime. No one likes a cruel person during his lifetime, and after his death, people curse him. On account of his self-identification with the body, he must be degraded and pushed into the darkest region of hell.
Lord Srila Prabhupada and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur make a comment on this. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, again in the mood of Kamsa speaking, if I kill the child to save my life, I will spend the rest of my life in misfortune. Those who perform cruel acts are dead even while existing within the body. If I commit cruel acts and die, people will curse me. And even while living, they will curse me. I will fear even being alive. They will shout in taunting voices, you should go to hell for this. Those who absorb the bodily conception of life and maintain their bodies by committing violence to others will surely go to hell. And then Prabhupada, he says some interesting things in his commentary on 22. He's paraphrasing Jiva Goswami in his Vaishnava Toshnitika. One who lives in the bodily concept, thinking I am this body, involves himself by the very nature of this conception in a life of sinful activities. Anyone living in such a conception is to be considered a candidate for hell. One who is in the bodily conception of life has no control over sense gratification. Such a person can do anything sinful, to eat, drink, be merry, and enjoy a life of sense gratification, not knowing of the soul's transmigration from one body to another. Such a person does whatever he likes, whatever he imagines, and therefore, being subject to the laws of nature, he suffers miserably again and again in different material bodies. In the bodily conception of life, a person is conditioned by karma, and as long as the mind is absorbed in karma, one must accept a material body. Sarira Bandha, bondage to the material body, is a source of great misery. So this is, he's putting it in a wider perspective so we can see what it means for us. Okay, let's go on.
Kamsa thus meditated on all the pros and cons of killing Devaki at that time. Kamsa finally decided not to kill Devaki right away, but to wait for the inevitable future. But his mind became absorbed in animosity against the personality of Godhead. He patiently waited for the delivery of the child, expecting to kill him, as he had done previously with the other babies of Devaki. Thus being merged in the ocean of animosity against the personality of Godhead, he began to think of Krishna or Vishnu while sitting, while sleeping, while walking, while eating, while working, in all the situations of his life.
Prabhupada says something about this. Very interesting comparison he makes. This is from his fourth book to 24. Krishna consciousness favorably cultivated one makes one completely happy. So much so that the Krishna conscious person does not consider Kaivalya Sukham or merging into the existence of Krishna to be a great gain. Kamsa, however, because of cultivating Krishna consciousness in a different way, that is, inimically, was uncomfortable in all the affairs of his life. Whether sitting, sleeping, walking, or eating, he was always in danger. This is the difference between a devotee and a non-devotee. A non-devotee or atheist also cultivates God consciousness by trying to avoid God in everything. For a non-devotee, the world is full of problems, whereas for a devotee, the entire world is full of happiness. This comfortable position of a devotee can be established by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Even when a devotee is superficially put into great difficulty, he is never disturbed at heart.
His mind became so much absorbed with the thought of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that indirectly he could see only Krishna or Vishnu around him. Unfortunately, although his mind was so absorbed in the thought of Vishnu, He is not recognized as a devotee because he was thinking of Krishna as an enemy. The state of the mind of a great devotee is also to be always absorbed in Krishna, but a devotee thinks of him favorably, not unfavorably. To think of Krishna favorably is Krishna consciousness, but to think of Krishna unfavorably is not Krishna consciousness. At this time, Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, accompanied by great sages like Narada and followed by many other demigods, invisibly appeared in the house of Kansa. They began to pray to the Supreme Personality of Godhead in select verses, which are very pleasing to the devotees and which award fulfillment of their desires.
Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur makes a very beautiful statement here. I'll first read the verse, it's verse 25. Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, accompanied by great sages like Narada, Devala and Vyasa, by other demigods like Indra, Chandra and Varuna, invisibly approached the room of Devaki, where they all joined in offering their respectful obeisances and prayers to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who can bestow blessings upon everyone. And then Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, he gives such an amazingly beautiful analogy. Listen carefully, it's quite subtle. So he's saying that this word Vishnam, the Lord who blesses all, refers to Lord Krishna, who is like a cloud that rains the nectar of his pastimes. So Krishna is like a cloud that rains the nectar of his pastimes. Brahma acts as the chief cultivator in the field of the 14 worlds. And Shiva is like the chief peacock with all his tail feathers spread, fondly dancing before the rains. Narada and other singers are like chatuka birds, expressing great longing for the rains of Krishna's pastimes. The demigods are like suffering elephants surrounded by the forest fire of Kamsa, Jarasandha and other demons. All of these demigods came to the prison house of Kamsa to glorify Lord Hari. That's a beautiful analogy.
The first verse they spoke acclaimed that the Lord is true to his vow. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna descends to this material world just to protect the pious and destroy the impious. This is his vow. The demigods could understand that the Lord had taken his residence within the womb of Devaki to fulfill his vow, and they were very glad that the Lord was appearing in order to fulfill his mission. Then the demigods addressed the Lord as Satyam Param, or the Supreme Absolute Truth. Everyone is searching after the truth. This is the philosophical way of life. The demigods give information that the Supreme Absolute Truth is Krishna. One who becomes fully Krishna conscious can attain the Absolute Truth. Krishna is the Absolute Truth because, unlike relative truth, he is truth in all the three phases of eternal time. Time is divided into past, present and future. Krishna is truth always, past, present and future. In the material world, everything is being controlled by Supreme Time in course of past, present and future. But after the creation, Krishna was existing, and when there is creation and everything is resting in Krishna, and when this creation is finished, Krishna will remain. Therefore, he is the absolute truth in all circumstances. If there is any truth within this material world, it emanates from the Supreme Truth, Krishna. If there is any opulence within this material world, the cause of the opulence is Krishna. If there is any reputation within this material world, the cause of the reputation is Krishna. If there is any strength within this material world, the cause of such strength is Krishna. If there is any wisdom or education within this material world, the cause of such wisdom and education is Krishna. Therefore, Krishna is the source of all relative truths.
Krishna talks a little bit about Satya Param, the absolute truth. Unlike the temporary results obtained from the demigods, surrendered to you is Satya Param. Satya here means extending in all place and time, and Param means the best. We take shelter of you, who are the best in all time and space. Satyam can also refer to his name. You are supreme and called Satya. Krishna is established in truth, and truth is established in Krishna. Govinda is more truthful than truth itself. Therefore, he is called Satya. Krishna's intelligence, strength, and all his transcendental qualities are also Satyam, absolute truth.
This material world is composed of five principal elements: earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And all such elements are emanations from Krishna. The material scientists accept these five primary elements as the cause of the material manifestation, but the elements in their gross and subtle states are produced by Krishna. The living entities who are working within this material world are products of his marginal potency. In the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, it is clearly stated that the whole manifestation is a combination of two kinds of energies of Krishna, the superior energy and the inferior energy. The living entities are the superior energy and the dead material elements are his inferior energy. In its dormant state, everything remains in Krishna. The demigods continue to offer their respectful prayers unto the supreme form of the personality of Godhead Krishna by analytical study of the material manifestation. What is this material manifestation? It's just like a tree. A tree stands on the ground. Similarly, the tree of material manifestation is standing on the ground of material nature. This material manifestation is compared to a tree because a tree is ultimately cut off in due course of time. A tree is called Vriksha. Vriksha means that thing which will be ultimately cut off. Therefore, this tree of the material manifestation cannot be accepted as the ultimate truth because it is influenced by time. But Krishna's body is eternal. He existed before the material manifestation. He is existing while the material manifestation is continuing, and when it will be dissolved, he will continue to exist. Therefore, only Krishna can be accepted as the absolute truth. The Katha Upanishad also cites this example of the tree of the material manifestation standing on the ground of material nature. This tree has two kinds of fruits, distress and happiness. Those who are living in the tree of the body are just like two birds. One bird is the localized aspect of Krishna, known as the Paramatma, and the other bird is the living entity. The living entity is eating the fruits of this material manifestation. Sometimes he eats the fruit of happiness, and sometimes he eats the fruit of distress. But the other bird is not interested in eating the fruit of distress or happiness, because he is self-realized. The Katha Upanishad states that one bird on the tree of the body is eating the fruits and the other bird is simply witnessing. The roots of this tree extend in all three directions. This means that the root of the tree is the three modes of material nature: goodness, passion, and ignorance. Just as the tree's roots expands, so by association of the modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance, one expands his duration of material existence. The tastes of the fruits are of four kinds: religiosity, economic development, sense gratification, and ultimately liberation. According to the different association in the three modes of material nature, the living entities are tasting different kinds of religiosity, different kinds of economic development, different kinds of sense gratification, and different kinds of liberation. Practically all material world is performed in ignorance, but because there are three qualities, sometimes the quality of ignorance is covered with goodness or passion. The taste of these material fruits is accepted through five senses. The five sense organs through which knowledge is acquired are subjected to six kinds of whips: lamentation, illusion, infirmity, death, hunger, and thirst. This material body or the material manifestation is covered by seven layers: skin, flesh, blood, marrow, bone, fat, and semen. The branches of the tree are eight: earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and ego. There are nine gates in the body: the two eyes, two nostrils, two ears, one mouth, one genital, and one rectum. And there are 10 kinds of internal air passing within the body: prana, apana, urana, vyana, samana, etc. The two birds seated in this tree, as explained above, are the living entity and the localized Supreme Personality of Godhead, Paramatma. The root cause of the material manifestation described here is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Personality of Godhead expands Himself to take charge of the three qualities of the material world. Vishnu takes charge of the mode of goodness, Brahma takes charge of the mode of passion, and the Lord Shiva takes charge of the mode of goodness. Brahma, by the mode of passion, creates this manifestation. Lord Vishnu maintains this manifestation by the mode of goodness, and Lord Shiva annihilates it by the mode of ignorance. The whole creation ultimately rests in the Supreme Lord. He is the cause of creation, maintenance, and dissolution. And when the whole manifestation is dissolved, in its subtle form as its energy, it rests within His body. At present, the demigods prayed. The Supreme Lord Krishna is appearing just for the maintenance of this manifestation. Actually, the Supreme Cause is one, but less intelligent persons, being deluded by the three modes of material nature, see that the material world is manifested through different causes. Those who are intelligent can see that the cause is one, Krishna. As stated in the Brahma Samhita, Ishvara Parama Krishna, Sarva Karana Karanam, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the cause of all causes. Brahma is a deputed agent for creation, Vishnu is the expansion of Krishna for maintenance, and Lord Shiva is the expansion of Krishna for dissolution.
Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur makes a brief comment about that in the form of a little conversation between the devas and Krishna. Krishna says, "O devas, it is said that Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva are the masters of this world, so why do you say that I am the creator?" And then the devas reply, "Those whose minds are covered by your maya see Brahma and others as independent. Those whose minds are not covered see only you, and see Brahma and others as your expansions only." So, I know what they're dealing with. Go on.
"Our dear Lord," the demigods prayed, "it is very difficult to understand your eternal form or personality. People in general are unable to understand your actual form. Therefore, you are personally descending to exhibit your original eternal form."
Jiva Goswami says something interesting about that. He tells us that the names and forms of Krishna are considered auspicious because they destroy all suffering and produce the highest bliss. Thus, these processes are by their nature the highest goal. One who is situated in his unlimited duties by becoming absorbed in your lotus feet goes beyond samsara. While the person who hears, chants, and remembers your auspicious names and forms, becoming absorbed in these devotional acts at your lotus feet, or becomes absorbed in your pastimes, is beyond samsara. Very interesting.
Somehow people can understand the different incarnations of your lordship, but they are puzzled to understand the eternal form of Krishna with two hands moving among human beings exactly like one of them. This eternal form of your lordship gives ever-increasing transcendental pleasure to the devotees, but for the non-devotees this form is very dangerous. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is very pleasing to the sadhus, paritranaya sadhu nam. But this form is very dangerous for the demons because Krishna also descends to kill the demons. He is therefore simultaneously pleasing to the devotees and dangerous to the demons. Our dear lotus-eyed Lord, you are the source of pure goodness. There are many great sages who simply by samadhi or transcendentally meditating upon your lotus feet and thus being absorbed in your thought have easily transformed the great ocean of nations created by the material nature into no more than the water in a calf's hoof print.
Krishna, I think Prabhupada has something to say about this. Prabhupada in his purport to 30 makes a brief comment. "Persons who have achieved knowledge by the association of devotees follow the Mahajans. Such a person always concentrates his mind upon the lotus feet of the Lord and executes one or more of the nine varieties of devotional service. Simply by this process, one can cross the insurmountable ocean of nisyance." And then Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur tells us, "Men of discrimination who meditate on your name, form, qualities and pastimes when you appear in this world, board the boat of your lotus feet and cross over the material ocean. For such great devotees, crossing the ocean of material existence becomes as easy as stepping over the hoofprint of a calf. They are not even aware of its existence. And then he makes a comment about the calf's hoof print. The material world is compared to the water in a calf's hoof print, because the water in a calf's hoof print is actually purifying and praiseworthy. In the same way, the devotee's impression that he's caught in samsara purifies the devotee of the disease of false identification and is therefore also praiseworthy. Very sweet. Read on.
The purpose of meditation is to focus the mind upon the personality of Godhead, beginning from his lotus feet. Simply by meditation on the lotus feet of the Lord, great sages cross over this vast ocean of material existence without difficulty. O self-illuminated one, the great saintly persons who have crossed over the ocean of nations by the help of the transcendental boat of your lotus feet have not taken away that boat. It is still lying on the side. If one takes a boat to cross over a river, and the boat also goes with one to the other side of the river, and so when one reaches the destination, how can the same boat be available to those who are still on this side? To answer this difficulty, the demigods say in their prayer to the boat of the Lord's lotus feet that the boat of the Lord's lotus feet is not taken away. The devotees still remaining on this side are able to pass over the ocean of material nature because the pure devotees do not take the boat with them when they cross over.
Bhagavad Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and Srila Prabhupada have some interesting comments to make about this. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur tells us that leaving the boat on the bank means that the devotees establish bhakti movements and then cross the ocean of material existence. This is what it actually means. They actually establish bhakti movements. And by this act, others are able to cross over the ocean of repeated birth and death. Prabhupada elaborates on this in a very beautiful way, and he's commenting in particular on the verse 31, so I'll read that verse. O Lord, who resemble the shining sun, you're always ready to fulfill the desire of your devotee, and therefore you are known as the desire tree. When acharyas completely take shelter under your lotus feet in order to cross the fierce ocean of nisyans, they leave behind on earth the method by which they cross. And because you are very merciful to your other devotees, you accept this method to help them. Purport. This statement reveals how the merciful acharyas and the merciful Supreme Personality of Godhead together help the serious devotee who wants to return home back to Godhead. It is the duty of the acharya to publish books that will help future candidates take up the method of service and become eligible to return home back to Godhead by the mercy of the Lord. In our Krishna consciousness movement, the same path is being prescribed and followed. Thus the devotees have been advised to refrain from four simple acts, illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating and gambling, and to chant 16 rounds a day. These are bona fide instructions, because in Western countries, constant chanting is not possible. One should not artificially imitate Haridas Thakur, but one should follow this method. Krishna will accept a devotee who strictly follows the regular principles and the method prescribed in the various books and literatures established by the authorities. The acharya gives a suitable method for crossing the ocean of nisyance by accepting the boat at the Lord's lotus feet. And if this method is strictly followed, the followers will ultimately reach the destination by the grace of the Lord. This method is called Acharya Sampradaya. The Acharya Sampradaya is strictly bona fide. Therefore, one must accept the Acharya Sampradaya. Otherwise, one's endeavor will be futile. So very, very amazing elaboration here that Prabhupada has given. He's actually explaining that the process itself is not the essence. The fact is that Krishna and his pure devotee have collaborated to come up with a scheme which, if followed, will give the result. So this is very, very interesting. Some people say, why only 16 rounds, why you have to follow four regular principles. They come up with comments like this. But Prabhupada is just saying, this is Acharya Sampradaya. This is what I've given. This is what I've left behind. Those who want to follow me and follow it sincerely and seriously, they'll cross the ocean of missions, they'll go back to Krishna. By the potency of Prabhupada, by the potency of Krishna, by the desire of Prabhupada, by the desire of Krishna, we'll attain. Isn't it amazing what Prabhupada is saying here? So it's a very powerful purport. It's 31, 31st purport. Read on.
The devotees still remaining on this side are able to pass over the ocean of material nature because pure devotees do not take the boat with them when they cross over. When one simply approaches the boat, the whole ocean of material nations is reduced to the size of the water in a calf's hoof print. Therefore, the devotees do not need to take the boat to the other side. They simply cross the ocean immediately. Because the great saintly persons are compassionate toward all conditioned souls, the boat is still lying on this side. In other words, one can meditate upon the lotus feet of the Lord at any time, and by doing so, one can cross over the great ocean of material existence. Meditation means concentration upon the lotus feet of the Lord. Lotus feet indicate Supreme Personality of Godhead, but those who are impersonalists do not recognize the lotus feet of the Lord, and therefore their object of meditation is something impersonal. The demigods express their mature verdict that persons who are interested in meditating on something void or impersonal cannot cross over the ocean of Nishayas. These persons are simply imagining that they have become liberated. O lotus-eyed Lord, their intelligence is contaminated because they fail to meditate upon the lotus feet of your Lordship. As a result of this neglectful activity, the impersonalists fall down again into the material way of conditioned life. Although they may temporarily rise to the point of impersonal realization.
Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments on this. Those who do not accept you have no realization of your sweetness and your merciful glance. They think themselves liberated, though they are completely bound in the material world. This is different from your devotees, who though liberated out of humility regard themselves as conditioned. According to Krishna's statement in Bhagavatam 11:14-21, only by executing devotional service can one appreciate me. Because of the absence of bhakti and the presence of offenses, the jnanis do not obtain the direct association of the Lord. Therefore, the burned up seeds of their karma again begin to sprout, and such jnanis fall into the mature world again. Sad state of affairs.
This is the 32nd verse?
This is, it's a long book, but 32, yes.
Impersonalists undergo severe austerities and penances to merge themselves into the Brahman effulgence or impersonal Brahman existence. But their minds are not free from material contamination. They have simply tried to negate the material ways of thinking. That does not mean that they have become liberated. Thus they fall down. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is stated that the impersonalist has to undergo great tribulation in realizing his ultimate goal. At the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is stated that without devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one cannot achieve liberation from the bondage of fruitive activities. The statement of Lord Krishna is there in the Bhagavad Gita, and in Srimad Bhagavatam, the statement of the great sage Narada is there, and here also the demigods confirm it. Persons who have not taken to devotional service are understood to have come short of the ultimate purpose of knowledge and are not favored by your grace. The impersonalists simply think they are liberated, but actually they have no feeling for the personality of Godhead. They think that when Krishna comes into the material world, he accepts a material body. They therefore overlook the transcendental body of Krishna. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Avajananti Mamura. In spite of conquering material lust and rising to the point of liberation, the impersonalists fall down. If they are engaged just in knowing things for the sake of knowledge and do not take to the devotional service of the Lord, they cannot achieve the desired result. Their achievement is the trouble they take, and that is all. It is clearly stated in the Bhagavad Gita that to realize Brahman identification is not all. Brahman identification may help one become joyful without material attachment or detachment and to achieve the platform of equanimity, but after this stage, one has to take to devotional service. When one takes to devotional service after being elevated to the platform of Brahman realization, he is then admitted into the spiritual kingdom of permanent residence in association with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is the result of devotional service. Those who are devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead never fall down like the impersonalists. Even if the devotees fall down, they remain affectionately attached to their Lord. They can meet all kinds of obstacles on the path of devotional service, and freely, without any fear, they can surmount such obstacles. Because of their surrender, they are certain that Krishna will protect them. As it is promised by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, my devotees are never vanquished.
Jiva Goswami, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, and Srila Prabhupada will comment on this. Jiva Goswami, in his full book of 41, he tells us, the Supreme Lord Swayam Bhagavan, endowed with all powers, not his expansion, appeared in her room along with, 40th text. Just as you appear in these forms and protect us now, please also protect us in the future. With great longing, they make a request for the future also. With that in mind, the demigods say, please remove the suffering of the earth. Though you killed Hiranyakashipu, Kalamani, and others when you appeared as Narasingha in other forms, now they have again taken birth and made the earth suffer. Therefore, now act in such a way that this will not happen again. The deep meaning of this statement is this. By killing and liberating the demons, we will no longer have to see them, since they will no longer take birth. Thus we devotees will gain the greatest benefit. And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he says, I'll read the verse, it's 33. O Mother, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord of the Goddess of Fortune, if the devotee is completely in love with you, sometimes rolled in the path of devotion, they do not fall like non-devotees, for you still protect them. Thus they fearlessly traverse the heads of their opponents and continue to progress in devotional service. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. Bharat, Indrajumna, and Chitraketu, who were great devotees, are not criticized even though they fell. Then why do the jnanis get criticized so heavily? This verse answers the question. The devotees on the path of bhakti do not fall like the pretenders of liberation. What to speak of giving up the Lord's lotus feet? Even if bhaktas fall in that state, they remain firmly attached to your lotus feet. Though Chitraketu, Bharat, and Indrajumna fell and took the bodies of demons like Vritra and others, their prem increased 100-fold. One should see their fall down as a cause for increasing prem. Their fall is not like the fall of the aspirants for liberation. For even in the fallen state, they remain firmly attached to your feet. They remain faithful to the Lord, thinking that their fall has been arranged by the Lord for their own benefit. For the Lord promises that his devotee will never perish. Being thus convinced of Krishna's protection, they tread over the heads of the demigods causing obstacles. In other words, they conquer over all obstacles. Another meaning can be that the devotees hold on their own heads the feet of the Lord, which destroy all obstacles. And then Prabhupada tells us also a little comment. A devotee is always protected by all of the Supreme Lord's opulences, of which no one can deprive him. Thus a devotee cannot be defeated by any opponents. A devotee therefore should not deviate knowingly from the path of devotion. The adherent devotee is assured of all protection from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. What a beautiful little insight that Prabhupada is giving us here. That the body can't be defeated, so don't deviate from the path. In spite of obstacles, in spite of opponents, don't deviate from the path. Stick with it, and you'll be assured of all protection by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Read on.
Our dear Lord, the demigods continued, you have appeared in your original unalloyed form, the eternal form of goodness, for the welfare of all living entities within this material world. Taking advantage of your appearance, all of them can now very easily understand the nature and the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Persons who belong to the four divisions of the social order, the brahmacharis, grihasthas, vanaprasthas, and sannyasis, can all take advantage of your appearance. Dear Lord, husband of the Goddess of Fortune, devotees who are dovetailed in your service do not fall down from their high position like the impersonalists. Being protected by you, the devotees are able to traverse over the heads of many of Maya's commanders-in-chief, who can always put stumbling blocks on the path of liberation.
This reminded me of a verse from the 11th canto and the purport to it. Very, very interesting. It's 11.4.10 in purport. The translation reads, the demigods place many obstacles on the path of those who worship you to transcend the temporary abodes of the demigods and reach your supreme abode. Those who offer the demigods their assigned shares in sacrificial performances encounter no such obstacles. But because you are the direct protector of your devotee, he is able to step over the head of whatever obstacle the demigods place before him. I read some of the purport. Although a Vaishnava, or devotee of the Lord, has no need to worship the demigods, being proud of their exalted material position, sometimes resent the exclusive devotion of the Vaishnava to the Lord, and thus try to cause the devotee to fall down. But the demigods here point out that Krishna is directly the protector of his devotees. Therefore, so-called impediments become stimuli for further spiritual advancement for a sincere devotee. The demigods here state, we thought, our dear Lord, that we could disturb your consciousness by our foolish tricks. But by your mercy, even your devotees pay little regard to us. So why should you take our foolish behavior seriously? The word yadi here is used to indicate the certainty that Krishna is always the protector of his surrendered devotees. Although there may be many obstacles on the path of a sincere devotee who is preaching the glories of the Lord, such obstacles increase the determination of the devotee. Therefore, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, the continuous obstacles presented by the demigods form a kind of ladder or stairway upon which the devotee steadily progresses back to the kingdom of God. Can't beat it. Vida.
Being protected by you, the devotees are able to traverse over the heads of many of Maya's commanders-in-chief, who can always put stumbling blocks in the path of liberation. Dear Lord, you appear in your eternal transcendental form for the benefit of the living entities so they can see you face to face and offer their worshipful sacrifices by ritualistic performance of the Vedas, mystic meditation and devotional service as recommended in the scriptures. Dear Lord, if you did not appear in your eternal transcendental form, full of bliss and knowledge, a form which can eradicate all kinds of speculative ignorance about your position, then all people would simply speculate about you according to their respective modes of material nature.
What Vishnu Chakravarti and Prabhupada comment on this. Vishnu Chakravarti comments, I'll read the verse first, it's 35. O Lord, cause of all causes, if your transcendental body will not be on the modes of material nature, one could not understand the difference between matter and transcendence. Only by your presence can one understand the transcendental nature of your Lordship, by the control of material nature. The transcendental nature is very difficult to understand unless one is influenced by the presence of your transcendental form. The demigods point to the womb of Devaki with an index finger and say, O Lord, if this form of yours was material and not sort of suffer beyond material contamination, then there would be an absence of devotees realizing a spiritual form. And then Prabhupada, he says something interesting also. Ajnanabhidha means that which can match all kinds of speculation. In ignorance, people are imagining the form of the Lord. Sometimes he has no form, sometimes he has form, according to their different imaginations. But the presentation of Krishna in the Brahma Samhita is vigyan, scientific experience knowledge given by Lord Brahma and accepted by Lord Chaitanya. There is no doubt about it. Shri Krishna's form, Shri Krishna's flute, Krishna's color, everything is reality. Here it is said that this vijnanam is always defeating all kinds of speculative knowledge. Therefore the demigods pray, without you appearing as Krishna as you are, neither Ajnanabhidha, the omniscience of spirit of speculative knowledge, nor vijnanam could be realized. By your appearance, the speculative knowledge of ignorance will be vanquished, and the real experienced knowledge of authorities like Lord Brahma will be established. Men influenced by the three modes of material nature imagine their own God according to modes of material nature. In this way, God is presented in different ways, but your appearance will establish what the real form of God is.
The appearance of Krishna is the answer to all imaginative iconography of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everyone imagines the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead according to his mode of material nature. In the Brahma Samhita, it is said that the Lord is the oldest person. Therefore, a section of the religionists imagine that God must be very old, and therefore they depict of the form of the Lord like a very old man. But in the same Brahma Samhita, it is contradicted. Although he is the oldest of all living entities, he has his eternal form as a fresh youth. The exact words used in this connection in Srimad Bhagavatam are Vijnanam Ajnan Bhidapamajanam. Vijnanam means transcendental knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vijnanam is also experienced knowledge. Transcendental knowledge has to be accepted by the descending process of disciplic succession, as Brahma presents the knowledge of Krishna in the Brahma Samhita. The Brahma Samhita is Vijnanam as realized by Brahma's transcendental experience, and in that way he presented the form and the pastimes of Krishna in the transcendental abode. This knowledge is called Ajnanabhidapamajanam, that which can smash all kinds of speculation in ignorance. People are imagining the form of the Lord. Sometimes he has no form and sometimes he has form, according to their different imaginations. But the presentation of Krishna in Brahma Samhita is Vijnanam, scientific, experienced knowledge given by Lord Brahma and accepted by Lord Chaitanya. There is no doubt about it. Krishna's form, Krishna's flute, Krishna's color, everything is reality. Here it is said that Vijnanam is always defeating all kinds of speculative knowledge. Therefore, without your appearing as Krishna, as you are, neither Ajnan Bhidapamajanam, destruction of the nations of speculative knowledge, nor Vijnanam would be realized. In other words, your appearance will vanquish the ignorance of speculative knowledge and establish the real experienced knowledge of authorities like Lord Brahma. Men influenced by the three modes of material nature imagine their own God according to the modes of material nature. In this way, God is presented in various ways, but your appearance will establish what the real form of God is. The highest blunder committed by the impersonalist is to think that when the incarnation of God comes, he accepts the form of matter in the mode of goodness. Actually, the form of Krishna or Narayan is transcendental to any material idea. Even the greatest impersonalist, Shankaracharya, has admitted, Narayana paro vyaktar. The material creation is caused by the avyakt, impersonal manifestation of matter or the non-phenomenal total reservoir of matter. But Krishna is transcendental to that material conception. This is expressed in Srimad Bhagavatam as Shuddha Sattva, or transcendental goodness. He does not belong to the material mode of goodness and is above the position of material goodness. He belongs to the transcendental, eternal status of bliss and knowledge. Dear Lord, when you appear in your different incarnations, you take different names and forms according to different situations. Lord Krishna is your name because you are all attractive. You are called Shyama Sundar because of your transcendental beauty. Because of your transcendental beauty, Shyama means blackish. Yes, yet it is said that you are most beautiful. You are more beautiful than the thousands of Cupid, Kandarpa, Koti, Kamaniya. Although you appear in a color which is compared to the blackish cloud, because you are the transcendental absolute, your beauty is many, many times more attractive than the delicate body of Cupid. Sometimes you are called Giridhari because you lifted the hill known as Govardhan. You are sometimes called Nandanandan or Vasudev or Devaki Nandan because you appear as the son of Maharaj Nanda or Vasudev or Devaki. Impersonalists think that your many names or forms are given according to a particular type of work and quality because they accept you from the position of a material observer. Our dear Lord, the way of understanding is not to study your absolute nature, form and activities by mental speculation. One must engage himself in devotional service, then one can understand your absolute nature and your transcendental form, name and qualities.
Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and Prabhupada comment on this. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur tells us, not only your form is Sudha Sattva, but also your name. Your transcendental name and form can be realized only by devotion. There is no other way. Even by chanting your name or meditating on your form, the casual observer cannot discern or realize your sweetness, nor perceive your qualities, birth, and activities. If one fails to realize the sweetness of your name or form, he has not attained any realization at all. It is like those afflicted with jaundice. Although chewing sugar candy, they cannot taste the sweetness. Similarly, those devoid of devotion cannot realize the sweetness of your name and form. Therefore, your name and form must also be Sudha Sattva, purely spiritual. And Prabhupada comments on his Purport to 36, only when one becomes spiritually saturated by transcendental service to the Lord are the transcendental name, form, quality, and pastimes of the Lord revealed to him. Since Krishna and his transcendental name, form, and activities are all of a transcendental nature, ordinary persons, or those who are only slightly advanced, cannot understand them. Even big scholars who are non-devotees think that Krishna is fictitious. Yet although so-called scholars and commentators do not believe that Krishna is factually a historical person whose presence on the battlefield of Kurukshetra is recorded in the history of Mahabharata, they still feel compelled to write commentaries on Bhagavad Gita and other historical records. Seva Mukhi Jivado, Krishna's transcendental name, form, attributes, and activities can be revealed only when one engages in his service in full consciousness.
Others may go on speculating for millions of years, but it is not possible for them to understand even a single part of your actual position. In other words, the Supreme Personality of God Krishna, Godhead Krishna, cannot be understood by the non-devotees because there is a curtain of Yoga Maya which covers Krishna's actual features. As confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Naham Prakasha Sarvasya, the Lord says, I am not exposed to anyone and everyone. When Krishna came, he was actually present on the battlefield of Kurukshetra and everyone saw him. But not everyone could understand that he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Still, everyone who died in his presence attained complete liberation from material bondage and was transferred to the spiritual world. O Lord, the impersonalists or non-devotees cannot understand that your name is identical with your form. Since the Lord is absolute, there is no difference between his name and his actual form. In the material world, there is a difference between form and name. The mango fruit is different from the name of the mango. One cannot taste mango fruit simply by chanting mango, mango, mango. But the devotee who knows that there is no difference between the name and the form of the Lord chants, Hare Krishna, Hare
Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare,
and realizes that he is always in Krishna's company. For persons who are not very advanced in absolute knowledge of the Supreme, Lord Krishna exhibits his transcendental pastimes. Such persons can simply think of the pastimes of the Lord and get full benefit. Since there is no difference between the transcendental name and form of the Lord, there is no difference between the transcendental pastimes and the form of the Lord. For those who are less intelligent, like women, laborers, or the mercantile class, the great sage Vyasadeva wrote the Mahabharata. In the Mahabharata, Krishna is present in his different activities. The Mahabharata is history, and simply by studying and hearing and memorizing the transcendental activities of Krishna, the less intelligent can also gradually rise to the standard of pure devotees.
Srila Prabhupada elaborates on this in his Bhagavatam purport. This is his purport to 36. For persons who are not very advanced in absolute knowledge of the Supreme, Lord Krishna exhibits his transcendental pastimes. They can simply think of the pastimes of the Lord and get the full benefit. Since there is no difference between the transcendental name and form of the Lord, there is no difference between the transcendental pastimes and the form of the Lord. Krishna is present in his different activities, and simply by studying, hearing, and memorizing the transcendental activities of the Lord, the less intelligent can also gradually rise to the standard of pure devotees. One should not give up the process of devotional service, which is performed in 9 different ways. The most important process is hearing from the Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, the spiritual master, the saintly acharyas, and the Vedic literature. Sadhu, Shastra, Guru, Vakya, Chitate, Kariya, Akya. We should not hear the commentaries and explanations of non-devotees, for this is strictly forbidden by Srila Sanatana Goswami, who quotes from the Padma Purana. We should strictly follow this injunction and never try to hear from Mayavadis, impersonalists, voidists, politicians, or so-called scholars. Strictly avoiding such an inauspicious association, we should simply hear from pure devotees. Shravan is very important, but one must hear from the Vaishnava Sadhu, Guru, and Shastra.
Actually, when this kind of a thing comes these days, like for example, this for those who are less intelligent, like women, particularly women, and the women these days, like even and some are so nice and everything, but they always have a big question mark and disagreement, and it's very difficult to. So how do we handle that? And or they're considered subordinate, or like Shudras in Bhagavad Gita shloka, there is there in the introduction also it comes. So they really, really then protest and they don't agree. So
yeah. Well, you give them a choice. In many ways you can approach it, but one way that you can approach it is you say, well, you have to make a choice. What kind of woman are you? Are you stree? Always looking for how to expand your interests and your belongings in the material world? Or are you Vaishnavi? Your statement is not referring to Vaishnavis.
Not referring.
There are other comments that Prabhupada also makes. This is why you have to remember that when you're reading a certain text like that, it's context reading. So you never take it just as that particular context. You'll always do a search for other statements Prabhupada has made. So Prabhupada has also made statements to the effect that Vaishnavis are as good as their husbands and expansions of Lakshmi. So you know, like, we just have to see that what kind of woman do you want to be? If you're talking stri, which means like ever expanding your enjoyment of the material world, then that's the kind of person. Because somebody who's preoccupied with sense gratification, their mind's not steady, they have no real intelligence to make a proper decision. So you just give them a choice. Where do you want to line up?
Okay, so it's basically you're referring to those kind of,
yeah.
I mean, that category.
Yeah, okay. You can have like many ways you can approach it. That's where it came to mind today.
The pure devotees who are always absorbed in the thought of the transcendental lotus feet of Krishna and who are always engaged in devotional service and full Krishna consciousness are never to be considered to be in the material world. Srila Rupa Goswami has explained that those who are always engaged in Krishna consciousness with body, mind and activities are to be considered liberated even within this body. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Those who are engaged in the devotional service of the Lord have already transcended the material possession. Krishna appears in order to give a chance to both the devotees and the non-devotees for realization of ultimate goal of life. The devotees get the direct chance to see Him and worship Him. Those who are not on that platform get the chance to become acquainted with His activities and thus become elevated to the same position.
Prabhupada makes this very common in relation to this. It's in his 39.4. There are philosophers who do not believe in the Lord's incarnation and who ask, why should the Supreme Lord come? But the answer is, why should He not come? Why should He be controlled by the desire of the living entity? The Lord is free to do whatever He likes. It is only for His pleasure that He comes, although He does not need to come. That's such a sweet comment. Yeah.
Our dear Lord, O Supreme Controller, when You appear on earth, all the demons like Kansa and Jarasandha will be vanquished, and all good fortune will be ushered into the world. When You walk on the globe, Your lotus feet will impress on the ground the marks of Your souls, such as the flag, the trident, and the thunderbolt. Thus You will grace both the earth and us on the heavenly planets, who shall see those marks.
Prabhupada also comments on this. I'll read the verse actually, it's verse 38. O Lord, we are fortunate because the heavy burden of the demons upon this earth is immediately removed by Your appearance. Indeed, we are certainly fortunate, for we shall be able to see upon this earth and in the heavenly planets the marks of the lotus, conch shell, club and disc that adorn Your lotus feet. And Purpa Prabhupada says, these marks on the lotus feet of the Lord are visible to the devotees who receive the causeless mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The demigods were jubilant, not only because the appearance of the Supreme Lord would do away with the burdensome demons, but also because they would be able to see upon the ground the transcendental marks of the soles of the Lord's lotus feet.
I have a question.
Sure.
Krishna doesn't have a trident.
No. And it's not mentioned in the Bhagavatam verse. From memory, tridents on the foot of Vishnu.
Yeah.
I have to check. Okay. Yeah, but it's in the Bhagavatam, it's mentioned lotus, conch, club and disc.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh dear Lord, the demigods continued, You are unborn, therefore we do not find any reason for Your appearance other than for Your pleasurable pastimes.
Jishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments on this. We have said that You have appeared for protecting us, but that is only a pretense. You perform Your birth and activities independent for Your own purpose. Although You are unborn, You appear in this world. We cannot determine the cause because the creation, maintenance and destruction are carried out by Maya, which takes shelter of You. Sri Krishna is called Abhaya, or instilling fearlessness, because by remembering Him, the fear of the demons like Kamsa disappears. Therefore, there is no necessity of the Lord to personally appear to kill Kamsa.
Although the reason for the appearance of the Lord is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, He descends just to give protection to the devotees and vanquish the non-devotees. Actually, He descends for His pleasure meeting with the devotees, not really to vanquish the non-devotees. The non-devotees can be vanquished simply by one kick of material nature. The actions and reactions of material nature, creation, maintenance and annihilation, are being carried out automatically. But simply by taking shelter of Your holy name, the devotees are fully protected, because Your holy name and Your personality are non-different. The protection of the devotees and the annihilation of the non-devotees are actually not the business of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When He descends, it is just for His transcendental pleasure. There cannot be any other reason for His appearance. Our dear Lord, You are appearing as the best of the Yadu dynasty, and we are offering our respectful, humble obeisances unto Your lotus feet. Before this appearance, You also appeared as a fish incarnation, as a horse incarnation, as the tortoise incarnation, as the half-man, half-lion incarnation, as the boar incarnation, as the swan incarnation, as King Ramachandra, as Parashuram, and as many other incarnations. You appeared just to protect the devotees, and we request you in your present appearance as the Supreme Personality of Godhead Himself to give us similar protection all over the three worlds and remove all obstacles for the peaceful execution of our lives. Dear Mother Devaki, within your womb is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, appearing along with all His plenary expansions. He is the original Personality of Godhead appearing for you, for our welfare. Therefore, you should not be afraid of your brother, the King of Bhoj. Your son, Lord Krishna, who is the original Personality of Godhead, will appear for the protection of the pious Yadu dynasty. The Lord is appearing not alone, but accompanied by His immediate plenary portion, Baladev.
Dev
Goswami
comments on this, and it's very sweet. Having praised the Lord while being invisible to others, the devotees then pacified Devaki, who was astonished by their presence. O Mother, she was most respectable because she was a mother of the Lord. Though it is said that she held the Lord in her mind, the Lord then appeared in her womb. Thus, it became suitable for the devotees to address her as a mother. The Supreme Lord Swayam Bhagavan, endowed with all powers, not His expansion, appeared in her womb along with Balaram. It should be understood that He appeared within her in order to be born. He has appeared for our benefit. What to speak of appearing for your and Vasudeva's benefit, He has appeared for us also. O He who has previously appeared for our benefit as expansions, like Matsya and other forms, has not appeared in your womb directly as Swayam Bhagavan. This is the supreme good fortune. And Devaki says, but I am afraid of the evil acts of Kamsa. To her fear, they reply, it is about to die. His actions will soon bring about his death. Do not fear him. But I don't know how much disturbance he will cause. They reply that he is the protector of all the others. What to speak of being the protector of Vasudeva and you, who are so close to him? In this way, the devotees constantly praised her day and night.
Devaki was very much afraid of her brother Kamsa because he had already killed so many of her children. So she was very anxious about Krishna. In the Vishnu Purana, it is stated that in order to pacify Devaki, all the demigods along with their wives used to visit her to encourage her not to be afraid that her son would be killed by Kamsa. Prabhupada
comments on this in his 39th purport. If we practice devotional service by always thinking of the Lord, always glorifying Him and always chanting about Him, we will be reinstated in our original constitutional position and thus be saved. The demigods, therefore, encouraged Devaki not to fear Kamsa, but to think of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who was already within her womb. This is such a beautiful lesson for all of us, that when we're in a fearful or a difficult circumstance, don't preoccupy yourself with the circumstance, preoccupy yourself with Krishna. Of course, we responsibly do what we can to protect ourselves in that circumstance, but we don't dwell on it. We dwell on the One who's just by remembering Him. Just by remembering Him, we can deal with the problem. Let's move on.
Krishna, who was within her womb, was to appear not only to diminish the burden of the world, but specifically to protect the interests of the Yadu dynasty, and certainly to protect Devaki and Vasudeva. It is understood that Krishna had been transferred from the mind of Vasudeva to the mind of Devaki and from there to her womb. Thus all demigods worship Devaki, the mother of Krishna. After thus worshipping the transcendental form of the Lord, all the demigods with Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva placed in front departed for their heavenly abodes.
Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur gives some interesting insight into why Brahma and Lord Shiva were placed in the front. And it really gives you an insight into the petty-mindedness and the self-interest, even amongst the demigods. You listen to this. After praising the Lord, whose form is transcendental, the demigods, thinking that Brahma and Shiva would see something wonderful, see some wonderful pastimes that they would miss, kept Brahma and Shiva in front of them, and then departed for the heavenly abodes. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purport of the second chapter of Krishna, prayers to the demigods, the Lord Krishna in the womb.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, 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 Hare Hare.
Vaishnava, 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 Vaishnava,